Yemeni army says it has launched a drone and ballistic missile attack on Aramco facilities in eastern Saudi Arabia. Heavy fighting is raging on in Afghanistan's Panjshir province, where both the Taliban and forces loyal to Ahmed Massoud claim to have the upper hand. And the family of a pro-independence Kashmiri icon is charged for allegedly chanting anti-India slogans and wrapping his body with Pakistan's flag after he died. Appreciate you being with us. Well, the Yemeni army says it has carried out fresh retaliatory attacks against Saudi positions in the kingdom's east.
The targeting of sites belonging to Aramco in Ras Tanura, Dammam in the east of Saudi Arabia, with 8 Samad-3 drones and 1 Zulfikar missile. Attacking Aramco sites in Jeddah, Jizan, and Najran with 5 Badr missiles and 2 Samad-3 drones. And the operation has achieved its targets, thank God.
The army spokesman said the attacks were carried out using drones and ballistic missiles. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province, as well as the cities of Najran and Jizan in the south. Yemen has stepped up its aerial attacks against Saudi Arabia in the past months in response to the kingdom's years-long war on the country. Yemen says the attacks will continue until Riyadh ends the conflict. The war has killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians and displaced millions since 2015. Activist and political commentator Hossein al-Bakhanti says the latest Yemeni attacks indicate that peace talks with Saudi Arabia seem to have not yielded positive results.
To focus on those oil facility, I think that Yemeni forces can bring down Saudi to its knee. And as well, they have target Aramco facility in Najran and Jizan and in Jeddah. This means that it is clear message that Yemeni ballistic drone unit and ballistic Yemeni drone unit and ballistic missile unit can actually cover all Saudi Arabia from Dammam to Jeddah to Najran to Jizan to Asir. And in this latest statement from Al Amid Sari', he has not actually mentioned what type of military site Yemeni army has conducted attack on. He only mentioned the economic side, and I think that this Saudi Arabia should learn that when Yemeni army actually in the last 3 months they have conducted only a few small attack on Abha airport, they were just trying to give time if there is any peace, if the Omani negotiation and Omani will help to bring Yemeni side and Saudi side to talk to the table. But this actually shows that when Yemeni army conduct this major and huge attack, this actually explain clearly that there is no any good coming from this talk and the negotiation led by Oman.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Well, heavy clashes are raging on in Afghanistan's Panjshir province, where the Taliban seek to take out the last pockets of resistance against their takeover of the country last month. The Taliban say they have advanced deep into the Panjshir Valley, north of Kabul. A spokesman says the advancing forces have captured 4 of the province's 7 districts and are inching closer to its center. But opposition forces reject the claim, saying they have confronted the Taliban. The National Resistance Front of Afghanistan, led by local leader Ahmed Massoud, says it has surrounded thousands of Taliban forces. In a Facebook post, Massoud has insisted that Panjshir will continue to stand strongly. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Amin Alami out of Kabul and Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer out of Westchester University. Westchester, Pennsylvania, thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with Amin and bringing us to date on the latest of what is going on there.
Well, Marzia, according to sources in Panjshir province, heavy fightings are underway between the Taliban and Northern Resistance Front in the Panjshir. Both sides are claiming that they have inflicted heavy casualties on each other. For instance, Fahim Dashti, who is one of the spokespersons of Northern Resistance Front in Panjshir province, say that at least 1,000 Taliban fighters have been surrendered, killed, or being trapped inside a valley of the Panjshir. But in the meantime, we saw that thousands of Taliban fighters were going to the Panjshir province, and the Taliban are also deploying extra military forces and military hardware to this strategic valley north of Kabul to capture it. Marzia, let's not forget that Panjshir province in north of Kabul is the only area that is not captured or controlled by the Taliban so far. The Taliban say that we will capture this strategic province in north of Afghanistan at any cost. In the meantime, sources close to Taliban, mainly the press office of the Taliban here in Kabul, say that the entire province is currently under the control of the Taliban, and some fightings are underway inside Bazarak, the capital of Panjshir province in north of Kabul. But the resistance front, led by Ahmed Massoud, the son of Afghanistan's national hero Ahmed Shah Massoud, says that we are resisting against the Taliban inside the valley, and we will not surrender to these forces. Ahmed Massoud says that we are ready to resume negotiations with the Taliban side in case the Taliban approve the demand of the people of Afghanistan, that is the establishment of an inclusive government that must protect the rights of women, men, and many other groups, particularly religious groups in Afghanistan. However, one of the spokespersons of the Taliban, particularly Dr. Naeem Wardak, who speaks in behalf of the Taliban's political office in the Qatari capital, Doha, said that we followed all the peaceful solutions to convince Ahmed Massoud to say yes to our proposal in order to form an inclusive government. But according to Taliban sources, Ahmed Massoud has ignored to say yes to Taliban demands. That is why Taliban are expanding their attacks all over the province to bring it under its own control, as the only area that has left to be under the to be controlled by the Taliban.
Well, Lawrence, your assessment of what is going on, a very difficult situation in general for the people, but one will ask the question, is it just the difficulty because of this change in government in itself, but also there are going to be major external factors. Their money are in U.S. banks, and of course the United States is not releasing that. The U.S. is talking about sanctions. Your overall assessment of the current situation there?
I think that the United States and its NATO allies are not in a position to come to the rescue, if you will, of the resistance fighters in Panjshir. All the reports I receive, I look at, say that the rebel forces are finite. That is, they have a limited number of people. It might be large, but it's finite. And their weaponry and resources are finite. And they haven't got an easy outside access to aid. And I don't think the Americans and the NATO forces are willing at this point to break that and to aid them. So I think that they're going to lose. They might have surrounded 1,000 Taliban, but 1,000 more will show up, and essentially they'll be worn down. I don't know how long it'll take, but I think that it's almost inevitable under the logistical circumstances we find them in. In terms of outside intervention or outside arrangements with the Taliban, I think that at least the Americans under the Bush, or rather the Biden administration, are in fact indicating that they are willing under certain circumstances to have an unwritten or unstated arrangement with the Taliban, particularly against mutual, what might be considered to be mutual enemies. ISIS, certain elements of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. You know, when you change administrations and make, either make peace or leave, all kinds of things can happen. When the Americans withdrew from Vietnam after all of that fighting and all that death and a million Vietnamese killed and what have you, they started to negotiate with the Vietnamese. It didn't come to anything, but they started to negotiate for a naval base at Haiphong Harbor. I mean, it's almost surreal, isn't it? I mean, that these things can happen, but they can.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you being with me on this news review out of Kabul, Amin Alami, and out of Westchester, Pennsylvania, Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer at Westchester University. At least four paramilitary personnel have been killed in an attack in Pakistan's southwestern province of Baluchistan. Police say over 20 others were injured after a suicide bomber detonated his explosives near a security checkpoint in the city of Quetta. Now, some of the wounded are in critical condition, and the death toll may rise. Prime Minister Imran Khan has condemned the attack. The Pakistani Taliban, known as the TTP, have claimed responsibility. The group has recently intensified its attacks against the Pakistani army. Meanwhile, police in Indian-controlled Kashmir have charged a family of late pro-independence leader Sayed Ali Gilani for chanting anti-New Delhi slogans. Now, the family is also charged for wrapping their father's body with Pakistan's flag. Police have accused them of raising anti-national slogans and resorting to other anti-national activities. Gilani's family has not been detained. They have not denied the accusations, but they say police took away Gilani's body after he died on Wednesday, preventing them from performing the last rites. That raised tensions in Indian-controlled Kashmir and prompted a lockdown, which was eased on Sunday. People there want independence from India or its merger with Pakistan that holds the other side of Kashmir. Let's cross over to Kashmir, joined by Shahana Bhatt. Shahana, thanks so much for being with us. Tell us about the overall situation and dealing, especially after Gilani's death.
Marzia, thank you so much. This is, of course, this was a known fact that when the leader of such a state chair, who people of Kashmir consider as one of the tallest resistance leader, will die, of course, people are going to join in large numbers. People are going to come and participate in the funeral procession. So government and authorities took a decision that once the great leader passed away, the entire valley went under a security crackdown and entire communication systems were blocked, including internet, cellular phones, and landlines for some time. Later, with each passing day, they restored landlines and broadband services, but still the mobile internet services continue to be suspended. Though people in some places tried to move out of their homes despite the curfew and restrictions imposed, and there have been clashes reported in some areas where youngsters have been injured because security forces used pellet shotguns to disperse protesters and not allow them to move towards the graveyard or towards the, to join the funeral procession. So before the funeral procession would occur, the authorities have taken the dead body, according to the family, said that he should be buried in the martyr's graveyard, which the police did not allow. So I spoke to Syed Ali Sheikh Gilani's younger son, Naseem Gilani, a while ago to know the update. So he, according to him, that during the time of his death, they have no idea. They were in an emotional turmoil, and they just got a report that police had charged them with UAPA, which is Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, and they've been charged for chanting slogans against India. They've been charged for pro-independence slogans, and of course, draping the body of late leader into the flag of Pakistan. So, according to him, he has no idea in the turmoil what has happened and what not. So he said that whatever the police has said and has done, we are still in turmoil and we're not able to understand what is happening. And during that turmoil, the body was taken from them and buried in a hurried manner, and they were ordered to do it before dawn so that people do not, in their emotional distress, come out and join funerals. So what and all I can tell you is that it is an emotional trauma for the people of Kashmir, because the stature late Syed Ali Sheikh Gilani had, and the kind of a leader he has been for the people of Kashmir, he is going to be remembered for the times to come. And people are, of course, shocked, but they see it as imposed silence, and they see it as a forcible silence imposed on them, and they feel helpless.
All right, thanks so much for that update. Out of Kashmir, Shahana Bhatt. Meanwhile, Indian farmers have held a massive rally in Uttar Pradesh province to protest against the government's agricultural reforms. More than 500,000 farmers attended the rally. Now, that's the largest in a series of such demonstrations in India over the past months. The protests began ever since the government introduced the agricultural reforms last September. It says the reforms will help farmers get better prices. However, the farmers say the measures favor private retailers and food processors. Thousands of farmers have also camped on major highways to the capital, New Delhi, over the past months to pressure the government to abandon the reforms. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thanks so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Melbourne psychologist Chris Cheer says the coronavirus pandemic's effect has been akin to grief, and acceptance of it is hard to reach. We now present you an article written by Calla Wahlquist under the heading Complex and Quite Ambiguous Loss: What COVID Has Done to Our Mental Health. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. After 18 months, psychologist Chris Cheers has begun to understand emotional responses to the global COVID pandemic as a kind of grief. It's a collective grief experienced by the whole world at once, but also deeply personal. Our losses are not the same, just as our experiences have not been the same. Some have lost loved ones from COVID and in other ways, and have been unable to attend funerals. Some have experienced a loss of health through long COVID, or a long-term loss of income or loss of work. The impact of both the virus and the restrictions have been disproportionate, affecting marginalized communities more than others. Psychologist Chris Cheers says it is a complex and quite ambiguous loss, which makes it difficult to process, adding, "When the losses are so ambiguous and complex, it's really difficult to reach that place of acceptance, so we just kind of get stuck. Stuck in the grief and stuck in the distress." The usual support networks that scaffold us in grief have also gone. In states with lockdowns in place, we are not allowed to gather and seek comfort from each other. And even when we are able to reach out, those who might usually offer support are grieving their own losses. Psychologist Chris Cheers says people's capacity to support each other, I think it's starting to diminish. When Australia first went into lockdown in March of 2020, Prime Minister Scott Morrison warned the pandemic could last 6 months. He was wrong, of course. The pandemic is still going, and the mental and physical effects of living under it have accumulated. Psychologist Chris Cheers added, "In terms of lockdown's impact on mental health and on the brain, this doesn't get easier, this gets harder." He added, "The impacts of stress and the impacts of all the loss that lockdowns bring are cumulative. That cumulative stress moves people away from the hope." Chris Cheers added, "During Melbourne's 112-day lockdown last year, there was a sense of collective purpose that provided some meaning behind the restrictions. We were locking down to save elderly people, to save our community. We were locking down one last time." Data from the Medicare benefits schedule shows a surge in demand for services during Melbourne's second wave of lockdown last year, which was not matched in other states. Chris Cheers says this year, with the Delta variant of the coronavirus racing against the vaccine rollout and winning, that sense of purpose has fractured to be replaced by a sense of frustration and anger. He says, "When that doesn't shift, it then moves to that hopelessness or apathy, which I'm seeing more and more in many clients now." His wait list has never been longer. The decision to double the number of Medicare-subsidized psychology appointments from 5 to 10 was welcome news for clients, but the number of psychologists has not changed. Even with a Medicare rebate, those booking a private psychologist have to be able to pay the gap. Doubling the number of sessions does not make it more accessible. The pivot to telehealth has also required a rapid reskilling. Chris Cheers has been conducting one-on-one therapy via Zoom in his spare room in Melbourne for the past 18 months, replacing years of practice in reading body language with a new skill of making eye contact through a webcam. He says, if you make eye contact with someone on video, it doesn't feel like eye contact because you're looking at them on the screen and not on the camera. He added, to make eye contact, I have to make up with the camera. So I feel like I'm doing therapy with a green light at the moment. And psychologists are also living in a pandemic, living through the same lockdowns and restrictions as their clients. Chris Cheer says it gives them a pathway to understanding and empathy, but it has also wrung them dry. He says, I think a lot of psychologists would join me in saying that right now we're exhausted, but we're all incredibly needed. He added, our wait lists are long, our clients are in need, and that's a very challenging place to be, to know that there is so much support that's needed that you can offer at the same time when your capacity to support is depleted. According to a new World Health Organization survey, the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted or halted critical mental health services in 93% of countries worldwide, while the demand for mental health is increasing. The survey of 130 countries provides the first global data showing the devastating impact of COVID-19 on access to mental health services and underscores the urgent need for increased funding. The survey was published ahead of World Health Organization's big event for mental health, a global online advocacy event on 10th of October this year that will bring together world leaders, celebrities and advocates to call for increased mental health investments in the wake of COVID-19. The World Health Organization, WHO, has previously highlighted the chronic underfunding of mental health. Prior to the pandemic, countries were spending less than 2% of their national health budgets on mental health and struggling to meet their population's needs. And the pandemic is increasing demand for mental health services. Bereavement, isolation, loss of income, and fear are all triggering mental health conditions or exacerbating existing ones. Many people may be facing increased levels of alcohol and drug use, insomnia, and anxiety. Meanwhile, COVID-19 itself can lead to neurological and mental complications such as delirium, agitation, and stroke. People with pre-existing mental, neurological, or substance abuse disorders are also more vulnerable to SARS-CoV-2 infection. They may stand a higher risk of severe outcomes and even death. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, said, good mental health is absolutely fundamental to overall health and well-being, adding, COVID-19 has interrupted essential mental health services around the world, just when they're needed most. World leaders must move fast and decisively to invest more in life-saving mental health programs during the pandemic and beyond. The survey evaluates how the provision of mental, neurological and substance abuse services has changed due to COVID-19, the types of services that have been disrupted, and how countries are adapting to overcome these challenges. Countries reported widespread disruption of many kinds of critical mental health services. Over 60% reported disruptions to mental health services for vulnerable people, including children and adolescents, 72%, older adults, 70%, and women requiring antenatal and postnatal services, 61%. 67% saw disruptions to counselling and psychotherapy, 65% to critical harm reduction services, and 45% to opioid agonist maintenance treatment for opioid dependence. More than a third, or 35%, reported disruptions to emergency interventions, including those for people experiencing prolonged seizures, severe substance use withdrawal syndromes, and delirium, often a sign of serious underlying medical condition. 30% reported disruptions to access for medications for mental, neurological, and substance use disorders. Around three-quarters reported at least partial disruptions to school and workplace mental health services, that is 78% and 75% respectively.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. There is perhaps no doubt that the transnational criminal syndicates and networks undermine the stability and security of all nations through their illicit enterprises, including the transshipment of drugs, arms, illegal contraband, trafficked women and children, laundered money, financial fraud, counterfeiting, and cybercrime. In the first part of the documentary, we saw that behind the supply of illicit goods and services is often a web of international organized crime. The interwoven strands of such illicit and criminal transactions make it almost impossible to separate one from the other. International criminals have tremendous financial resources and spare no expense to corrupt government and law enforcement officials. They also have extensive worldwide networks to support their operations and are inherently nimble, adapting quickly to change. Stay with us as we further investigate these issues in the second part of the documentary.
Villas and castles, luxury hotels, real estate, bank accounts. The range of riches seized each year by the Italian justice system makes one dizzy. In 2010, it was over 9 billion euros, nearly 5 billion in 2011. It gives some idea of the financial clout of organized crime. And this is just in Italy. Money laundering is at the heart of the mafia infiltration. On Rome's Via Vivento, the Café de Paris is a showpiece. Photos of Mastroianni or Fellini decorate the walls. But now the ghost of the 'Ndrangheta boss haunts it. After months of investigation, Italian investigators discovered that this cult symbol of the Dolce Vita belonged, in fact, to Calabrian clan boss Vincenzo Alvaro. Alvaro had organized his business through many shell companies run by men of straw. Another type of laundering circuit is the Japanese ants. The Japanese mafioso gives some false tourists, the ants, a sum of dirty money and air tickets to Paris. The ants buy luxury items, leather goods, perfumes, haute couture. Back in Japan, the ants hand them to the trafficker and receive a small commission. The luxury goods go into the window of a boutique. Paris luxury goods, owned by the mafia. When they're sold, the circle is complete. Money laundering became more sophisticated in the 1980s. Franklin Gerardo was one of the architects of this new era. Financier of the cartel of Cali, after studies at Harvard, Gerardo set up a circuit that still works today. Drug traffickers were amassing huge fortunes thanks to drugs. Gerardo split the process into two phases. It's simple, but you need to listen carefully. Let's say I'm a Colombian drug dealer. I travel to a Caribbean tax haven and deposit my suitcases of cash in a bank account. No one's the wiser. My dirty money is then transferred to another bank, in Germany perhaps, into the account of a front man. Now it begins to branch out. The money is transferred and circulates between dozens of ever more respectable banks. Across dozens or hundreds of bank accounts, in Monaco, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, or Austria, to avoid drawing attention to the banking authorities, the transfers are never over $10,000. For the second phase of the Gerardo cycle, I need to get the money back to Colombia. Through men of straw, I set up European companies. These will invest the laundered money in my name in restaurants and property in Colombia, quite legally. Dispersion, concealment, and globalization become the keys to criminal finance. It's hardly surprising that Gerardo's scheme began in the 80s. Under the influence of Thatcher and Reagan, a new ideology was preaching deregulation as the sine qua non of economic policies. Shady capitalism takes root. Finance becomes queen. It was a gift for people wanting to recycle dirty money. Criminal money swims like a fish in deregulated financial waters, following the currents used by money from political corruption and tax evasion. Currents that take it to places smelling of holidays and dirty money. The Cayman Islands and the Virgin Islands, Panama. But not just them. There are about 50 tax havens around the world where the money circulates nonstop. The spider's web of the illegal economy. John Christensen is a leader in the fight against tax havens. He knows them well. He was economic advisor to the government of Jersey for 11 years.
When I was working offshore in Jersey, in the finance world, the fees that I charged were much higher than anything one would charge working in normal, legitimate activity, because they're expecting higher fees, because they want you to work on their side. What they're paying you for is what the Swiss call discretion, what I would call secrecy. In other words, you are not going to cooperate with investigators. You're going to put every single barrier in the way of investigation. At one stage, I was investigating on behalf of a client, a gigantic petrol company. I was investigating one Russian company. They were thinking about doing a joint venture. And this company was set up with structures in Jersey, in Cyprus, in Switzerland, in Delaware, in the Netherlands, across a whole range of different tax havens. Nobody knew who owned that company. Nobody at all. We suspected, and we involved Russian intelligence in our investigations, we suspected that it belonged to the very highest levels, politically, in Russia at that time, the very highest levels. But we could never get the evidence. The evidence was, in fact, kept in a safe in a law office in Cyprus.
In Cyprus, Jersey, and Monaco, at these counters of the black economy, silence is well rewarded. And nobody's complaining.
It corrupts the lawyers and the bankers and so on because they are effectively colluding with criminals, and they know they're colluding with criminals, but the money's far too seductive to turn down.
In the secret world of international finance, nothing looks as clean as dirty money. The biggest money laundering centers are some of the most select towns in Europe. Tranquil, Switzerland, for example. 30 kilometers of Zurich, the canton of Zug, is one of the flagships of financial obscurity. Over the years, the transnationals have set up their headquarters in Zug. Xstrata Glencore, or Transocean, leader in oil drilling, involved in the pollution of the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. Where is the criminal money in all this? In this faceless world of illegal capitalism, it's impossible to identify it. So fraud or blindness? There is another financial center that perfectly illustrates this outlaw capitalism where everything gets mixed up. It may be the atomic heart of a system out of control. London and its sacred enclave, the City of London, leading deregulation since the 1980s. All the players and tools of criminal finance are here, using all the methods of the classic hoodlums.
London is very attractive for money launderers on many, many fronts. And far better educated people than me have commented that London is the number one offshore tax haven in the world. We're offshore to Europe. We're having some interesting dialogue with Europe at the moment in relation to our financial services status. But we're also offshore to the rest of the world. And our Commonwealth heritage with the Cayman Islands, with the British Virgin Islands, with Belize and many other offshore jurisdictions, gives us quite a strong position.
If you look at many of these small islands, they have a shared characteristic, and that characteristic is their stamps carry the head of Britain's Queen there on the stamp. They fly the Union flag, and this isn't an accident. This has been part of the City of London's development strategy.
London, hub of the world's financial movements, whatever the color of the money.
If you can push your money into and take your money out of London, you once again have this appearance of legitimacy. If the money has been good enough for London, then it's good enough for anyone.
The international community has been fighting money laundering since the 1990s. An intergovernmental organization, the FAFT, has made a list of recommendations. Their calls for transparency have been quite ineffectual. The mafias aren't affected by the economic crisis. In fact, the current financial depression may well be a fabulous opportunity to consolidate their position. Faced with this major challenge of our time, our leaders seem to be either blind or resigned, or something more. Martin Woods has witnessed this deadly addiction. He was involved in the greatest money laundering scandal ever. In 2005, this ex-Scotland Yard man was engaged by the London branch of the big American bank, Wachovia. Woods soon identified clients linked to Casas de Cambio, the Mexican Money Exchange Bureau.
What we saw were large batches of travelers' checks, sequentially numbered, bearing illegible signatures, no dates, and critically, no identification features upon the rear of any of the checks to enable me to ascertain who it was who presented the checks. Back to basics, who was the customer? We couldn't see that.
Martin Woods alerted his bosses. He didn't know he was not alone. The U.S. federal authorities were also watching Wachovia, especially after the Mexican army intercepted a plane in 2006. Hired by the cartel of Sinaloa, the plane was full of cocaine. The investigation showed it was bought with money passing through the Wachovia bank.
There were some bankers who were engaged in marketing this service to Casas de Cambio customers and providing banking services that were used to launder money. And when I confronted and challenged this, I was confronted, challenged, and even attacked by the bankers for my own conduct.
Despite the evidence gathered by Woods, the bank ignored this and directed all its criticisms towards him.
I didn't have support from my departmental bosses. In fact, I found no support there whatsoever. And it took the bank a long time to realize that money did not control me. Money did not influence me in the same way that it influenced them. And this was rarely emphasized when my boss telephoned me in 2009 to tell me that my bonus for 2008 was zero. That was a very defining moment.
The outcome of this exemplary story is Woods was fired. When the American justice system caught up with Wachovia in March 2010, it got off with a ridiculously low fine.
I cannot explain or understand why the Justice Department decided not to prosecute the Wachovia managers. Perhaps something is related to the crisis and the fear that after the collapse of a big bank in the U.S., Lehman Brothers, another big bank, Wachovia, would fail. That may be an explanation, but it may also show that the presence of mafia money is so strong that it has become irreversible and they are not even prosecuted.
In 2008, Wachovia was bought by a rival, Wells Fargo, which paid the bill, a fine of $150 million. Grotesque, when we know that in total, Wachovia laundered $378 billion, an astonishing sum, one-fifth of France's GNP.
I cannot, honestly, think of one single bank in the world that has not been touched by this problem. To an extent that some of my very militant colleagues who are concerned about all this say that it is not mafia looking for banks, they're banks looking for mafia money.
I think, you know, there were bankers who have to question themselves and perhaps should be questioned by authorities as to what they were doing. Ultimately, how close is a launderer's finger to the trigger of the killer's gun? Who knows?
While on the surface, we see that the integrity of banking and financial services depends heavily on the perception that it functions within a framework of high legal, professional, and ethical standards. And a reputation for integrity is one of the most valuable assets of a financial institution. The fact is that the policy of silence prevails, and criminal finance is shaping the economic, political, and social landscape of our modern world. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another Aperture. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.